So, Jim, we are on episode 7, and this is going to be a barn burner. We have got two really, really impressive guests to talk about something that I think is on everybody's mind, and that is why should we care about the defense of Taiwan? And so the first person we're going to introduce is Major General Mick Ryan, AM, Royal Australian Army retired. I first met Mick when he was the commander of the Australian Defense College, and I was the defense attaché there with you, Jim, in 2018, and he was there until his retirement in 2021. Mick is the author of two books so far, I believe. The first one is War Transformed, which is all about the future of warfare. And the second is a fiction book, White Sun War, The Campaign for Taiwan, which, of course, is one reason we really wanted to talk to him today. He also has a Substack called Futura Doctrina, which we'll let him talk about in a little while. So who else do we have, Jim?
Well, Ray, we got Mike Studeman, Rear Admiral, U.S. Navy, retired. Mike's had an incredible career. He retired as Commander of Naval Intelligence. And we worked together a little while at Indo-PACOM, where he was the head of J2, the intelligence part. So it was he's got a lot of insights into what we're talking about, into what everyone agrees is one of the potential hotspots going forward. So we kick it off. So Mike Studeman, all those Americans out there who think Taiwan's far away and maybe not worth fighting over, why should we as Americans care about the defense of Taiwan?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I think it's really worth talking about. And I think that our leadership in the White House probably needs to do more conversations with the country about why Taiwan matters. And it's worth kind of just doing a thought experiment for a little bit and saying, okay, what if China was able to successfully compel unification? You know, what would America lose and what would China gain? And if you permit me to kind of run down that list a little bit, you know, America would lose the following. They lose credibility regarding U.S. commitments to a free and open Indo-Pacific, a Chinese-speaking democracy in Asia, a counterpoint to the Chinese sort of view that Chinese can only live within an authoritarian system, right? So it's a living contraposition to the Chinese sort of narrative there. We would lose access to a top 10 trading partner of the United States, very little understood by most Americans. We would lose allied and partner confidence in U.S. security commitments and a willingness to protect friends in a very critical region, a region which is going to be the engine of growth for the 21st century world. We would lose credibility of the U.S. military in the eyes of our adversaries. And if we do it without fighting or with fighting, either way, you know, we have weakened deterrence on other issues globally. We lose an ability to forestall a further erosion of the international norms and rules-based order. It's going to become a more Hobbesian world. It's going to be the same sort of thing with Russia and Ukraine's. You're going to see more actors are more willing to change and upend the world-based system, particularly when strong countries can get away with it. We would lose something that is very little understood, I think, in the world, and that is critical intelligence collection opportunities versus China. We have a lot of things that go through Taiwan, and understanding what's happening in China to a certain degree comes from our relationship with the Taiwanese in this respect, something to also mark. We would also lose international influence and standing, and there'd be an enhanced perception of U.S. decline, all right? That's what we would lose. And some of those individually you'd want to unpack because the significance of them are so high to the future standing of the United States, allies, and other interested parties in the world. So what would China gain? Just permit me to run down this list for a second. So China gains a major China rejuvenation victory. Xi Jinping calls recovering Taiwan the essence of rejuvenation. In other words, they can't rejuvenate successfully by 2049 unless they recover Taiwan. So it'd be a major victory. There'd be extraordinarily new legitimacy for Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party. It'd be an ideological win over democracy, freedom in the West. There'd be an assimilation of a major economy. There'd be new strategic advantages to the Chinese for projecting military power from that sort of unmovable aircraft carrier that's jutting out further into the Western Pacific there. That would mean domination of sea lines and choke points and exclusive economic zones, particularly of Japan and the Philippines and others who are already taking a look at territorial aggrandizement by the Chinese and are very, very concerned about where this is going. We would lose control over critical technologies that Taiwan produces. Semiconductors is usually where the conversation goes, but Taiwan produces many more electronic types, and our supply chain is more dependent on other things other than semiconductors there. There would be access, the Chinese would have, and exploitation opportunities against U.S. weapons. That's maybe a lesser issue, still one of them. And if you take a look at the repercussions globally, you'd find that more countries would, in fact, defer to the Chinese and their comprehensive national power and influence. And so you have essentially momentum for new forms of assertiveness. And so the Taiwan issue is not just about Taiwan. Some in the Japanese government have said, hey, the fault line of the international order lies along the first island chain, where Taiwan sits directly right there. And I think that's true, that the balance of power in many ways will be determined by the fate of Taiwan. It's worth protecting. It's worth knowing more about each of the things I talked about, because the American public needs to be educated to get their buy-in for doing hard things to be able to support Taiwan.
Well, that was super comprehensive, and I appreciate that. Now, Mick, coming at it from your perspective, especially from an Australian perspective, you know, Taiwan can seem awfully far away and maybe remote to Australia's national concerns. Why should we care about the defense of Taiwan?
No, thanks. It's hard to follow Mike on that. There are two small islands of 25 million people that are democracies in the Western Pacific. One's Taiwan and one's Australia. I think they're both worth defending, either or. It's actually a very precious thing. It hasn't been around for much of human history. It's only been around for a couple of hundred years over several thousand years of history. And it's taken a lot of work to get us to where we are. So every part of the world where there is democracy is worth defending, and the Taiwanese have certainly earned it. They've worked extraordinarily hard to build the vibrant democracy they have now. It's not how they started, and they've come on a long journey, and that is worth protecting. At the end of the day, you know, I look at if Taiwan's not worth defending, well, why is Japan worth defending? Why is Australia worth defending? I think there's a lot of areas in commonality there. One of the arguments I see from some is this notion of spheres of influence. I think it's a concept. And the reason I think that is because countries, if they're in a sphere of influence, should benefit from it. And when you're in the sphere of influence of an authoritarian power, you only lose. So there's a moral challenge in accepting that some countries might be part of China or Russia's sphere of influence, because they only lose because of that. We should reject this idea of China's natural sphere of influence. There's no such thing. And I think, you know, strategy needs to embrace the ethical and moral elements, not just the hard power elements, to reject those kind of ideas. Two final things. Firstly, I think that if the US didn't defend Taiwan, you would see a breakout of nuclear weapons in the Western Pacific. I think that is a near certainty for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it would be clear that conventional deterrence isn't working in the Western Pacific and countries need to reach for other tools. But secondly, the Western Pacific will see it absolutely as an abandonment of the United States, regardless of the ambiguity over the last several decades. That is how it will be viewed. Countries like South Korea, Japan are already thinking about this. Japan is 1 year short of it, has been for a long time. But other countries, potentially Indonesia, I think, and Australia would seriously consider it, so they should, I think. And finally, I think that the loss of Taiwan would usher in a new dark age for the world, where predatory authoritarians have momentum in both the physical world as well as in the information space. And we should be doing everything to ensure that doesn't happen, because that will not see a more prosperous and secure world. It will result in exactly the opposite.
Well, you guys made a pretty strong argument for the host of reasons why Taiwan is worth defending. But Mick, I wanted to ask you, in the U.S., yes, we've had years of strategic ambiguity, although President Biden now has said four times it's not ambiguous anymore. And what's interesting is neither Congress nor the general public or press really pushed back against that. Meanwhile, I guess a week or two ago, our Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, in an interview said that the submarines that will be part of the AUKUS deal could be used in the defense of Taiwan, and it created a firestorm. Now, could you explain that? Is Australia feeling bullied into defending Taiwan? How do we think about this?
No, I think the reality is Australia doesn't think about it most of the time. You know, you've both served here. I think generally Australians are pretty complacent about national security. They still think we're a long way from the world and not much impacts on us, and you know, no one's going to invade us, so why do we need a strong military? That is the view of a large proportion of people in this country, and besides Anzac Day, they don't really think about the military a whole lot. I think, however, if you have a look at the polls, a lot of Australians think Taiwan is worth defending. The problem, or I guess the differences in view, is about to what degree should Australia be involved. And, you know, when you have a look at a sliding scale of different military commitments, you get different responses from people in the Lowy polls. So I don't think anyone's feeling we're being bullied into this. I think you've got a government in Australia at the moment that national security just isn't its bag. You know, domestic social issues really are its focus. And where it is being drawn into national security, it really just wants to focus on drinking kava on little islands in the South Pacific. So, you know, I think you've got a convergence of a national culture that's largely complacent. You have a current government that's focused on the South Pacific. And, you know, I think when Taiwan comes up, most people kind of really need to take some time to think through why we might help Taiwan, notwithstanding the ideas that I just explained or might just explain. So I don't think it's about forcing Australia. I just think it's a very immature strategic conversation here.
You know, Mike, there's the old saying coming out of Soviet Russia that you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. And a couple of your former bosses have been in the news in the past year plus, sort of throwing around dates. You know, Admiral Davidson, of course, was quoted as worrying about 2027, while General Minahan, of course, even throughout the date of 2025. Are we looking? I mean, what is the significance of these dates that people are choosing? Why is it that we're sort of focused in on the middle part of this decade as sort of a place that we're focusing a lot of our attention?
Yeah, thanks for that. Look, you got a body of intelligence to begin with, which we can't talk about here, but let's just say it's relevant. Secondly, you know, Xi Jinping was very open. He accelerated some modernization goals from 2035 to 2027. And it's not just about, hey, we're going to have, you know, improved mechanization, informationization, intelligenceization of the PLA. It also happens to be the centenary of the PLA, 100 years since they were established. And so these are meaningful things. And one of the initial mandates of the PLA was, in fact, to essentially win the Civil War and defeat the KMT, a task that remains unfinished, right? Because you still have Taiwan as an outlier, sort of splittist in their parlance entity that suggests, in fact, that the motherland hasn't, you know, fully come together and been healed as a single entity led by the CCP. So those things are kind of running in there, but it's very clear from a variety of different things that Xi Jinping wants to have Taiwan options earlier than the mid-2030s, when he is, you know, in by that time in his 80s, right? Think about the timeline and his longevity. And so the PLA has been doing everything in every warfare area, which, you know, there's a study that hasn't been done that should be done to compare the speed of Germany's rise, right, in the 1930s to what China has done in the last 10 years. So you can look at Japan's rise. Any of these powers that ultimately led by authoritarians with grievances that had ambitions where they were driven by messianic kind of goals, we're in this sort of same headspace and the same kinds of things are happening. And so history is rhyming a lot, and we would be wise to take Xi at his word. He has been preparing his people, his military, his officials, his population for recovering Taiwan, and he has explained that that's key to ensure China is able to restore its place, you know, as the strongest pole in a multipolar system and take center stage in the world. He has done a number of other things to prepare for putting his country into a wartime environment, most of which people are just not connecting the dots. And that's the reason I wrote the War on the Rocks article to say, hey, look at the military, the governmental, the leadership, the economic, all of these indicators of preparation indicate a very serious country that is sprinting towards trying to do something that their leader is telling them that they must do. And we need to take it as seriously and not sort of be naive about what our adversary's intentions may be. I believe that you can, in fact, achieve deterrence if you're very good at deterrence. But I think it's eroding, and I think we have more to do.
Well, that's the $64 question, right? How do you deter an autocrat who's been preparing for years and sees this as the apex of his reign? So what do you think deterrence looks like going forward?
Yeah, I mean, the deterrence has to be focused on the decision maker. And given the centralization of authority under Xi Jinping right now, you know, it's whatever's in his mind. And so there are fears and there are biases, and a smart opponent would try to understand them and then use them for the effects that they'd like to see. Today, Xi Jinping feels like the PLA is not quite ready. How do we convince him that, in fact, they won't be ready 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 7 years, 9 years, et cetera? And so this is something that we'll have to do, but it's going to require strength. It's going to require expressing sort of an iron will to do certain things, a commitment to a coalition of friends in the region, right, where people can protect one another in a way that is prepared for a contingency that would be the most stressing kind, right, among those countries that will be directly impacted by what happens. And so there's lots of ways that you buy deterrence other than just sheer military capability, but you got to have that too. And so, you know, we have to look at this as a comprehensive problem that requires varsity work every single day. Otherwise, we're fated to actually see this thing transpire, and the whole world will be a loser from it, right? The oft-quoted figure is that the global economy loses $10 trillion. 10% of the global GDP will vanish like that. And so how do you mobilize more than just a few countries to be able to help you in your deterrence efforts? That's a key question too, and a matter of influence and persuasion.
So Mike is talking about deterrence, which is something that I used to know how to talk about once upon a time when there was a Cold War on and we all sort of talked about nuclear deterrence. And then it seemed like there were a couple of decades where we sort of lost the language of deterrence. We didn't really know how to talk about it anymore. But recently, it seems like we might even have been seeing a breakdown of deterrence. So Vladimir Putin was not deterred from going into Ukraine. Hamas was not deterred from attacking Israel. Do we know how to do deterrence anymore? And can China be deterred?
Well, I think there's a couple of things when it comes to deterrence theory that probably need to be updated. Firstly, when you mention the term, most people go straight to nuclear weapons, and that is a really important part of deterrence, but it's not the entire thing. And secondly, I don't think it's taught to the degree that it used to be taught during the Cold War. It was such an important part of strategy in the Cold War. You wanted to deter a nuclear war for very good reasons. It would end human life on this planet. I think kind of forgotten that. The Israelis talk about it all the time. You know, you go there, particularly in the wake of the Hamas attacks, and they talk about re-establishing deterrence constantly. Even if it's manifestly failed, they want to re-establish it. In this country, we really don't have a body of work on deterrence. We talk about it as an outcome of our white papers. The most recent National Defence Strategy talks about a strategy of denial, but never really uses the term deterrence by denial, which is really the right lexicon and the ideas. And it doesn't talk about how we're going to achieve it. But my view is, and I've got a paper coming out in CSIS in the coming week on this, is we really don't have a theory of conventional deterrence for middle powers. And I think that's really important because that is actually the majority of the world. There's less nuclear powers and you can count on my toes. And the rest of us are still trying to deter without nuclear weapons, even though we may still exist under a nuclear umbrella or extended nuclear deterrence. And I think for countries like Australia, countries like Taiwan, new era theories of conventional deterrence in the 21st century is worthy of a lot more work. The final challenge with deterrence is as soon as you start talking about it, people leap straight to military solutions. Deterrence is not a military mission. Deterrence is a national mission. It, especially in a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons, it has to encompass everything from intelligence to mobilization models for industry and for people, civil defense, as well as military affairs. So I think there's a whole range of challenges which we can address if we want to, but I don't think we've applied the intellectual horsepower we haven't mobilized the intellectual horsepower using current lexicon to really think through what deterrence means in the 21st century.
Can I build on the comment that there? I think he's got it all right. And I would say that an example of deterrence outside of military channels is to take a look at the use of economic tools and bundling packages of economic options that you might use as your first response to deter something that looks like it's on the cusp of being executed, rather than sort of just simply moving military platforms into posture, that there could be a number of different things that you signal that they're on a hair trigger to be executed that course continues with the opposing camp. And, you know, there are things like de-swifting. I mean, that's a very significant step to take with any country, for example. But there are other things that you could put in your package. And we need to think through this in both respects. Number one, what do we have that's viable that has some effectivity related to economic and maybe other option sets? And then secondly, what happens when the other guy does that to you? And then what are the consequences and what costs are you ready to bear when you take a look at second and third order effects based on sort of now this economic tit for tat? That requires much more analysis and examination. And I think that we haven't yet fully thought through what our deterrence toolkit looks like. And you need to be able to op test these things, subject them to tabletop exercises, maybe some modeling and simulation to see how this actually might be in a certain combination much more effective than other combinations. So that's point one. The other point that I'd make is that if we are just totally obsessed with deterrence and we're thinking about stopping a cross-strait invasion, I think we're going to overweight all of our energies into a single scenario. And I think you can end up losing the peace while you're trying to prepare to win the war. So in other words, like deterrence is not sufficient as a geopolitical strategy to pursue everything under that rubric. And what I saw in the U.S. military was this sort of obsession at the altar of the words integrated deterrence, right? And you had a lot of people thinking that's everything that we do. It all has to be under, we work together, integrated, and we're going to deter as in stop. And the reality is that the world is showing us that you're not going to stop these people. Like, they're going to continue doing things with regard to malign actions or some of these more aggressive acts. And we have to understand how we're going to operate in that world and still be able to maneuver. So you have deterrence, but you need to also have assurance. And assurance can go to your allies and partners, but assurance can also be directed at your opponent to assure them of X, Y, and Z, right? Some of it can be some benefits, and some of it can be costs that you assure the other guy. And then in addition to deterrence and assurance, you have just general shaping. In other words, a struggle for advantage throughout the world. And I wish that people would think through that you can actually strengthen integrated deterrence by the avenues of assurance and shaping for advantages that ultimately buy you back a certain a degree of deterrence that will shape the other actor who happens to be the antagonist. You see how I think they're related, and I think we've left this thing too simplistic to drive our energies as a country and a system of allies.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with the lessons we learned from Ukraine for deterrence. So clearly, Putin underestimated Ukrainian resolve. Xi, by all accounts, has seen the Ukrainian reaction and ability to push back, and the Western ability to supply Ukraine, slow as it may be and insufficient as it may be, but still enough to hold the line more or less. So what does Xi learn from that? And what have we learned to increase Taiwan's resilience? That's one. Two, of course, is do we have confidence the Taiwanese would fight as hard as the Ukrainians?
I'll take them both, but the second one first. If you talk to a lot of senior Ukrainian military officers, none of them expected the response from the Ukrainian people that occurred in first few months of this war. None of them. They thought their country was full of lazy Western-oriented people who were focused on material outcomes, just like many of us see our own society. So they were shocked and pleasantly surprised by the response of the Ukrainian people. And, you know, it's amazing what an existential threat can do to focus your mind on certain problems. I think when it comes to lessons for deterrence from Ukraine, I mean, Putin made three big assumptions about this invasion. Firstly, that the Ukrainian government was not resilient enough to stay in power and would leave the country after a 7-day, 10-day rapid advance on Kyiv. The second assumption was that the Ukrainian military was the same one that he'd faced in 2014. Which was, even by the Ukrainians' admission, a total disaster of a military, but it wasn't. It changed a lot in 10 years. And his third assumption was that the West would act in the same way that it had in 2014, which was kind of say, you know, we really don't like that, but we're not willing to go out on a limb and do anything really bad against Russia to prevent you invading the Donbass and taking over Crimea. So he made those three assumptions. He might have got away with it if one of them were wrong, but all three were wrong. But it lends a really interesting conversation about deterrence. You know, the West really didn't do much to deter Putin, even though Putin had been telling us for years he was going to do this. I mean, this is what authoritarians do. They tell us what they're going to do. Xi's been telling us. Putin has been telling us. You know, he's been telling us he's going to exterminate the Ukrainian state, the Ukrainian people, and that's what he's doing. And Hitler did this. So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised when they finally do it. So I think there's a lot of lessons for deterrence. And then since the war has begun, you've seen a lot of self-imposed deterrence. You know, and the first week was, you know, giving the Ukrainians artillery will be escalatory. And then we gave them artillery and nothing happened. Giving them armored vehicles will be escalatory. We did that, nothing happened. Giving them tanks, giving them F-16s, giving them advanced air defense. We've imposed all these red lines on ourselves. And Putin is just because he knows he doesn't have to do much other than mention the N-word every now and then. And we go into this escalation terror that seems to drive decision making in certain national capitals, including my own. I mean, we're probably one of the worst. So, you know, I think there's a huge amount that we can learn, not just for deterrence theory in the modern age, but how individual countries and how alliances make decisions in the face of large, powerful countries making threats about the use of certain weapons, including nuclear weapons, but not restricted to them. You know, it could be large-scale cyber attacks, could be the use of biological and chemical weapons. There's a huge body of work. If you talk to senior Taiwanese, talk to the national security advisors, foreign ministers, these kind of people, they're watching this closely. And they're not just looking at how the West has made decisions about Ukraine. They're also looking at, you know, how do you ensure you look like you're worth defending? As a foreign minister said to me, if you don't help yourself, no one's going to help you. So national will is a really important part of this entire conversation.
So just to kind of move this along, there's a question that's been nagging at me, Mike, and I really appreciate your insight. Conventional wisdom basically has it that Xi Jinping will invade or will at least take action, take military action against Taiwan if, one, he believes that he's not likely to get Taiwan back by other means, by coercive means, by, you know, so basically he has to do it. And two, that he will do it if he believes he will win. You know, and maybe three, that he believes that his window of opportunity is closing. Is that how you look at it? Or is the conventional wisdom, you know, off by a little bit?
No, I don't think that's wrong. I think it's just incomplete. I think that there are lots of other factors in the decision calculus. And look, this has to be a guaranteed slam dunk win for Xi Jinping. Otherwise, his life is at risk, his mandate at a minimum, the legitimacy of the party. I mean, there's a lot to lose here. So it has to be a win. And that's the reason why you see the PLA overbuilding. I mean, getting, you know, so much capability here to be able to confront any scenario where it's just Taiwan, the U.S., and maybe other actors that are responding there, a short war, a long war. They have to be ready for it all. And so this explains why you see some of the actions and decisions being made, particularly with the insulating of the Chinese economy, where it makes no business sense, no commercial economic sense, but it makes every sense when you're taking a look at the lens of preparing for the recovery of Taiwan through the most extreme means necessary, if required. He would love to have, of course, the political win of Taiwan folding from coercion, a more intensified activity that could be a combination of cyber activity or, you know, just missiles that take out key nodes and make life very, very hard for the average Taiwan person. You can paint a scenario where Taiwan capitulates with a great deal of damage from virtual or physical effects that have nothing to do with the cross-strait invasion per se, right? But let me add some other points that may be useful to think about. If you're Xi Jinping, you're going to be taking a look at a number of different factors. You're taking a look at the correlation of military forces. You're taking a look at the will to fight, the Taiwan side. 70% are polling like they say that they would be ready to fight if it comes to that. But you'd have to take a look at the way that Xi Jinping is taking a look at other things too. Does he perceive that the geopolitical risks are manageable, right? Some of that is a function of how co-opted he has made many states around the world. How many are going to be willing to apply sanctions against China and for how long? When you have many states, I mean, China's a top trading partner for 120 countries right now, right? That's a lot of countries that he can essentially neutralize, threaten, et cetera, to not do anything, including say one word of criticism about China going over and doing something violent against Taiwan. He's going to be rating that. Like, how much support do I have there? How strong are these parties, not just militarily, but politically? Is America still riven with polarized culture war politics where they can't, you know, make a decision in a timely way on anything because it's just warring factions? right? What does that look like? What has a future president been strong on a commitment to intervening, or are they going to walk away from Taiwan because you're isolationist and foreign wars just aren't my bag anymore? Sorry, I care about, you know, workers in Pittsburgh only, right? So that what the president comes into office with and what they believe and say and do really matters. Other things, how's the PRC economy going, right? Is it humming along? Is it actually starting to founder? What is the domestic pressure on the CCP? Do they need a wag the dog kind of situation to build nationalism to restore their legitimacy? And, you know, have my methods short of war been truly effective, or should I give them more time? In other words, am I seeing that I'm working my way towards a win without fighting, or have I truly concluded that I've tried everything and now that it's ineffective and I really need to go to sort of the last option that I never really wanted to do, but ultimately I'm finding my decision making leads me there, right? And so if you package all those together, Ray, you're probably going to get the factors that weigh on the mind of a guy like Xi Jinping.
You know, Mick and I were at a conference last month where we talked about Taiwan. A lot of the participants felt that what's more likely than kinetic action is strangulation of Taiwan, either slowly or quickly. And it doesn't have to be blockades. It can be taking action against anyone who trades with Taiwan, or creating situations where Taiwan can't get insurance for ships or airplanes. All sorts of possibilities to create economic chaos, and I don't even go into cyber. So measures short of war. And as we've seen in the West, it's awful hard to motivate us in the best of times. So under that scenario, what do you think happens? What do you think the West reaction will be? What do you think the Taiwanese reaction will be?
Yeah, for a blockade is what you're asking.
Well, blockade or something close to a blockade.
Yeah. You know, I think that the Chinese will be very astute in terms of using lawfare and how they're justified in moving and how the blame is on somebody else, and that what they're going to do is a quarantine, not a blockade, you know, to try to use our history to sort of say you can get away with these things. So that might be the approach to justify and establish legitimacy for these actions, right? And so when you see precursor events like that, you should be thinking more seriously about the COA, the course of action that they may be starting to move towards. I think that the Chinese have considered all courses of action like this. Like, there's lots of different ways that you have been, you know, asked if you're in the Chinese defense establishment on how you're going to contribute to this problem sets. A blockade's been considered and planned, et cetera. But, you know, how successful they're going to be when essentially a blockade makes everybody able to respond and move everything forward for a slow developing crisis, because a blockade immediately won't pinch, right? That kind of scenario where it becomes this long drawn out thing may not be in the best interest of the Chinese. And so we've seen thinking with regard to lightning strikes, try to get it over and have it a fait accompli before more forces can arrive from anywhere to support the Taiwan population. But this blockade, you know, onboards, you know, a number of different risks and scenarios which could really work against the Chinese. So there are advantages, but the disadvantages in terms of, let's say, the blockage of energy flows via a variety of means to slowly strangle China as well. You'd be applying Chinese pain against Taiwan with external actors' pain being applied against China simultaneously. And that's how you would see that sort of play out as people figure out what amount of pain can each side endure. Right? Who has the greater will? Who has the greater staying power? Who has the ability to actually break one another's blockades? And how that's done could lead you to a full-fledged war, right? There is a way that that leads to a full-on combat environment. But yeah, it's not it's not necessarily, I think, the preferred COA, the preferred course right now, given that it allows time for everybody, including the world, to watch China slowly strangle an innocent victim, right?
So, Mick, you literally wrote the book on this, right? So you actually went through the exercise of trying to imagine what a 2028 war over Taiwan would look like. What made you sort of settle on the scenario you did? What made you look into, you know, the some of the uses of you know, futuristic kinds of, you know, of weapons at the same time as it was a very sort of land-centric, human-centric story? What made you sort of go in that direction, and what, you know, what was the experience like trying to think through a war in Taiwan?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of drivers. Firstly, I went through the exercise of what was China's strategy taking Taiwan back. And, you know, in the book, there's a briefing, you know, what is the enemy thinking here? And I came to, you know, the same conclusions that, you know, one option is just to let it happen naturally. Well, that's not going to happen. I don't think that's a prospect anymore. The blockade, I think, is a far more difficult proposition than many of the simple so-called military strategists propose. It's actually a really bad option for China because it gives the world time to see them what they are. And imagine if the US said, we're going to blockade the port of Shanghai. You know, and frankly, it also has to succeed. Otherwise, Xi's dead and the CCP is delegitimized. So, I thought the bolt from the blue, which is how we used to describe, you know, rapid nuclear attacks, I think a bolt from the blue Chinese attack is probably the most likely, even though it may only be a 10% chance in the next 5 or 10 years. The environment, I chose it because I got sick of all these war games that just focused on the naval battle. And it's like, you know, there's lots of green bits in Asia. There's lots of blue. No one doubts that. But there's lots of green bits, and you can't win a war without winning on the green bits. This is not going to be a decisive naval showdown. It will be an important part of it as air ops, space ops, cyber ops, information, all that will be important. But the war on the land was something I thought that was being undertreated and underappreciated. Because at the end of the day, China has to take over the land of Taiwan. Not just the air over it or the cyberspace that it might use. And that involves people on the ground fighting and killing. So I wanted to have a look at what does that look like? What are the technologies that might have an impact? And, you know, some of it's based in reality. A lot of it is actually. I spoke to people at the US Space Force and other places. But there are other areas where I just made stuff up because that's the thing you can do in a novel if you're projecting a few years into the future. You can make stuff up because the enemy's going to surprise us. If there's one certainty about a war over Taiwan, and there aren't very many, I can tell you, but if there's one, I think the Chinese are going to surprise us, and we need to condition our minds to being surprised and having the strategic, operational, and tactical resilience to deal with it and fight through that surprise. It's what's happened in every other war democracy fought in the last 100 years. And I think we need to accept that there will be surprise throughout, and we need to be able to deal with that.
Well, Mick, thanks for the defense of land forces in the Pacific. I'm sure Mike appreciates that too as a Navy man.
Well, I'm talking at LANPAC about it in 2 weeks, so I'm looking forward to it. But the Indo-Pac J2 staff have asked me to come in and talk about the book as well, so I'm sure they'll get my impassioned defense of land operations at the same time.
Yeah, defense in depth for anything. I mean, so the Taiwans are taking it seriously. It's not just fighting the crossing or at the beach. It's about, you know, everything that Taiwan can do to use their natural strengths, which include the terrain, to their advantage. And then all the way into urban combat, sabotaging your own lines of communication, being able to, you know, take out ports or whatever, and be able to absorb whatever is thrown against you and essentially allow the invader to be attrited in a way that they can't sustain over time. And in fact, you know, when we talk about the defense of Taiwan, a population-centric types of defenses are things that are going to generate the greatest fears in China, right? If you're only going against a active duty military, which is less than 200,000 people, and that's the only thing you need to deal with, that's one thing. But when you're dealing with the potential for a large fraction of the 24 million people that could all contribute all the way Ukraine defended its own territory because it's an existential crisis, then the problem set goes up by orders of magnitude. And so this is what Taiwan needs to communicate very clearly. And they're already working on things that relate to civil defense and emergency services and first responders and a number of ways that they intend to mobilize the population. They're already very good at responding to earthquakes and typhoons and things like that. They have a great basis to be able to respond in a concerted fashion to danger. And so they've got a groundwork here to further build on. And this is what, when we talked about decision-making and deterrence, one of the best ways to deter China is to say, I'm going to tear a page out of your playbook, which is to say, you believe that about the efficacy of populations being able to essentially turn the tide of war. And so that's exactly what Taiwan needs to do and then convey so that China has to worry about a being bogged down if they ever make it across the strait.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a fascinating discussion. I do want to give you guys a chance just to tell us a little bit about what you're working on and where people can find your work. So, Mick, what are you working on now and where should people keep in touch with you?
So as usual, I'm working on multiple things. I have a portfolio of things. I have a book on Ukraine, particularly looking at how strategy and adaptation have had an impact on the war. That comes out in August from USNI Books. Doing a lot of work with CSIS and the Lowy Institute on military affairs, defense strategy, those kind of things. And then finally, I'm also doing a PhD in creative writing, which is producing a novel set in the 1980s in Australia. So a few things on the boil in addition to all my travels to wherever there is a war or likely future war to occur.
Well, it's really incredible that you spend an hour with us. Mike, how about you? What are you working on and where can people
keep Yeah, thanks. Up? Yeah, I've affiliated myself since retiring with the National Bureau of Asian Research, a very centrist think tank with legends in the Asian community that are there, and I'm on the board of advisors and doing a number of activities there. I'm part of a consulting group, West Exec. I'm a national security fellow, part-time at MITRE, which is a not-for-profit serving the public sector, supporting a variety of different projects. I've signed up as well with Leading Authorities, Inc. to be able to go on speaking circuits. I make myself available for those. I also have a book coming out on leadership, which I put together as a transition project after retiring. And it's going to be called The Might of the Chain, Forging Leaders of Iron Integrity. I think our nation faces a leadership crisis of massive proportions. And so I'm going to try to do my part to allow some of the up and comers in our country to see what leadership, when executed properly, looks, feels, and smells like. So that book should come out sometime late summer. So looking forward to maybe getting that around.
All right. Well, make sure you let us know so that we can properly give it its due exposure.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us, and thanks for explaining why we should care about the defense of Taiwan.
I appreciate it, Jim, Ray, Mick. Thanks. It was a wonderful hour.
Thanks, guys.